Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did our first glimpse of the Earth from far above change the scope of human imagination and the course of human history? Those unprecedented images of land from above the clouds came to us not from NASA or even from the Wright brothers, but from the intrepid pioneers of balloon flight, who as early as the late 18th century realized that lighter-than-air gases could fulfill our ancient dreams of defying gravity. Balloons have long since been replaced by more reliable forms of transportation, but they have never lost their ability to inspire and delight us. British Academy fellow Richard Holmes tells the stories of some of the most remarkable balloonists and the journeys they took in his new book, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. Richard, welcome to Think.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
You open the book with a lovely little story of how your own dreams of flying were born. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's true. This is a little, it's just a short opening. When I was about 4 years old, I had an uncle who I much admired, who was a Royal Air Force pilot. He was a rather tall, serious guy who never said very much, but I really listened to what he said. One day he took me to a little fete, a little fair in the countryside in Norfolk, where I grew up, and he bought one of those little helium party balloons. You know those things that... Mm-hmm. Just that they let, if you let go, they go to the ceiling.
Right.
I'd never seen one of these before. Huh. And it was bright red, and he tied it onto the top button of my little AirTex shirt, all right? Now, I was 4 years old, and I felt this thing pulling, and I thought, this is going to take me up in the sky. And I held on very tight to his hand, and then he turned to me, and with a kind of smile, he never used to say much, he said, "Richard, maybe you will fly." Hmm. And he let go of my hand. And at that moment, I thought I was taking off. I was falling upwards. And that's a very early memory. And that's how I begin the book. And I don't say what happened next, all right? I leave that to the reader's imagination. But it began as like so many things, like it's a little childhood dream moment that I keep repeating. And then later in my life, I got more involved with flying. But that's how it all began.
What does it feel like to go up in a hot air balloon?
Well, now, I tell you, I've just been up this morning, actually, just up the Hudson River, a little balloon station up there called Randall's Airfield. It was a lovely morning. We started before the sun was up. A lot of balloon flying is either done in the early morning or late in the afternoon, because the winds are calmer. And the first thing is you kind of... completely different from flying. Most of us are used to flying in big airliners and so on. The experience is entirely different. The first thing that happens is you're in the basket, and although you've got a propane burner heating the air, that's often switched off at that point. They let go of the guys holding the basket. And the effect is that the earth just drops away. Hmm. It's not like taking off with a roar in an aeroplane rattling bang. It's just silently drops away, and the landscape spreads out beneath you, and you suddenly start seeing things very, very differently. This morning, we flew along the edge of the Hudson, and one of the striking things is the beautiful fall foliage. But if you see it above, you're looking straight down through the trees. You see the animals and the deer dancing around, and gradually the panorama opens up wider and wider, and you begin to see the patterns, the river and the little townships. And this morning, it was the time the school buses were just about coming out. You know, the yellow school buses.
Yeah.
And all the kids were along the road, and we were probably at 500 or 600 feet. But you could see them, and they were all waving and calling up to us. Right? So ballooning produces this kind of delight in people, whether you're in it or you're watching it. So that's the second thing about it.
Well, you know, when you talk about nothing looking the same from above, this is something that took Henry Mayhew, the London journalist, by surprise.
Yes, very good question. We're now in the mid-19th century, the period he knew. Henry Mayhew was a brilliant journalist who worked for the novelist Charles Dickens. Okay, they knew each other very well. And Mayhew had written a series of pieces about really the poor in London. Particularly about the East End and the people who did the really rough jobs on the streets and so on. And he knew it very well, like a modern reporter. And he decided, he finished this collection of pieces, which is called London and the Labouring Poor, and he suddenly thought, I've spent my time kind of right down in the alleys and the back streets of London. Why don't I go up and fly above it for once? Take what he called the angel's eye view. So he went up in a hydrogen balloon with one of the great British balloonists, a chap called Charles Green. We might come back to him. Mm-hmm. And Charles Green flew him from above London, following the line of the Thames, from the West End to the East End. And what he saw, and he wrote this wonderful article, big, big feature piece, and he said, first of all, I saw, for the first time, I got this idea of a modern industrial city with all the sound of labor coming up. And then I realized that the West End was the rich folks lived there, and it looked different, and as the afternoon wore on, they started lighting the gas lights. It's lit differently. It smells differently. Well, smells different. And as you go towards the East End, the lighting changes. He could see how much poorer the district was. Again, it smelt differently. And suddenly you get a view of what one of the early modern industrial cities looked like from the air. And it's a completely original piece of journalism. And Dickens was so impressed that he got pieces of this put in his own magazine called the Household Magazine. So that's one example of it, the way it sort of transforms your view of the world, and in this case, of a city.
Charles Green, am I right, made just an astonishing number of balloon flights in his life.
Green, yes, amazing man. If you any visitors ever get to London, National Portrait Gallery, there's a wonderful picture of him there. This chap made, I think it was 526 flights, 526 flights in his lifetime, and he never had a bruise. And he flew first of all, kind of novelty flights. Can you imagine this? When he was starting to earn his money, he used to take off on the back of a pony. They'd link the pony to the balloon, and he went up throwing out things, beans and things from the horse. But gradually, he became more serious. And they were using, up till then, very expensive hydrogen gas, and he worked out a method that he could use ordinary coal gas, the gas which was beginning to light the streets, and it's much cheaper. So he could make cheaper balloons, and he worked for one of the big pleasure gardens, Vauxhall, down there, and they realized balloons were a wonderful publicity feature because you could see a balloon for miles, and it drew people to the gardens. And gradually, as he became more expert, he started on some very long-distance trips. And the ones I describe was in 1836, so we're looking back a bit. And he took three other guys, one of whom was an Irish writer who wrote a wonderful account of this. And they flew from London right down across the British Channel, and it got dark, and they flew right through the night eastwards. And they went really to the edge of Germany. It was an amazing flight, 480 miles. And the Irish writer on board, who's called Monk Mason, wrote this wonderful account. I'll tell you one thing. So they went over Liège, which is one of the first fully industrialized areas in Europe. And they flew at 1 in the morning over the iron foundries of Liège. You imagine this, flying maybe at 2,000 feet. And he said the whole horizon was lit up with the light of these iron foundries. He'd never seen anything like it before. It smelled differently. He could hear the workers who were laboring 24/7 all night long. He could call them calling, shouting, and sometimes laughing, and that the smell of the foundries. And he said this was the new, he was seeing the future. He also wrote a wonderful account of flying in the dark, where he said later on, when they're traveling over Germany, no starlight in the pitch black. And he said, it's a wonderful image. He said it was like we all fell rather silent, because the darkness seemed to close in, and it was like flying into the middle of a block of black marble, okay, as if they were going into a tomb. And the interesting thing, the way I work, I'm interested not only in the science, but the way the imaginative writers respond to this. Our own American, Edgar Allan Poe, read this account, and he started using those images of being entombed in his stories, and he wrote one of his very earliest stories was an account of how Mr. Green and his two compatriots had flown from Ireland right across the Atlantic to America in 3 days. And he published this story in the New York Sun, brilliantly detailed story, very dramatic, all the science correct, only one thing. It was Edgar Allan Poe, and it was completely a fiction, a hoax story. Okay,
but you had to read to the end to find that out, right?
Yes, that's right. They ran it for 3 days, and they sold more copies in that paper than they'd ever sold before. And then at the end, he revealed that it was a hoax story. So I'm very interested in the way not only the actual ballooning, but the effect it has on people's imaginations. It's a good example.
Richard Holmes is my guest. He's a fellow of the British Academy and author of the new book, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. We'll come back to our conversation with Richard in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. If you are ready to support KERA now with a contribution in any amount, you can do that online at kera.org or over the phone at 888-694-6931. If you want to make a gift of $120 or more, we can thank you with a copy of Richard Holmes' fascinating, and I'm not kidding, fascinating new book, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. Welcome back, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris. We do have copies of the book, Falling Upwards, by our guest, Richard Holmes. This is a great conversation, and much like the last hour, Chris, I'm worried that we are actually much like all week so far. I think we're straying into these guests are far too interesting for the membership campaign. There's a bit of a balance here because we want you to listen, right? But we also want you to take a moment and call 888-694-6931 or take a minute while you're listening to go to kera.org and fill out the membership form yourself, make a contribution to the station. And that's what this little handy break is for. You'll just hear Chris and me for the next minute or so encouraging you to make your contribution.
And listen, all of you who listen while working, you can easily go online and get this done. We know that you're accustomed to listening to fascinating things and getting other business done at the same time. But we also know that KERA is a big part of your day, whether it's part of your day early in the morning as you're getting ready for work, or maybe you have a commute in the evening and you just are so thankful that we always have All Things Considered to listen to. Maybe Think and Anything You Ever Wanted to Know are what you count on to get you through lunch hours. We are so happy to be here for you, and we are in existence thanks to the generosity of regular people just like you and me who make contributions to KERA.
888-694-6931, online at kera.org. Chris is right. The station wouldn't be here without people who've supported it. Coming up in July is KERA Radio's 40th anniversary, and the only reason the station has been around for four decades is because people just like yourselves, people who listen, people who believe in the importance of public radio, people who value these kinds of conversations, people who value the respect that everyone is given on public radio, those people have given money to the station. And that's really what we're asking you to do. We're asking you to open up your wallet, you know, pull out a couple of 20s and send them to KERA. Do it online at kera.org or call 888-694-6931. We guarantee we'll use your contribution to pay the bills here at KERA.
And paying the bills at KERA allows us to provide you with the programming on the air and also online that you rely on KERA for every single day of the year. It just takes a couple of minutes to set up a membership online, particularly a sustaining membership, which is an automatic debit account or credit card account draw. You will set it and forget it, as Ron Popeil used to say. Mm-hmm. And it works really well for us, too, because we know that we can count on that source of income into the future.
We're not going to dehydrate your fruit, but we
That's
will.
That's a service we're not planning to add
will
to
put
our...
We will put your contribution to work.
888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You can also do this online at kera.org. Perhaps choose a copy of Richard Holmes' new book, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Richard Holmes. He's a fellow of the British Academy, and his new book is called Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Richard, before the break, you were talking about this book also being an exploration of how literary writers of the day looked at ballooning and the possibilities of it. I think Victor Hugo's take on the importance of ballooning is really fascinating, even if it turned out to be somewhat misguided.
Yeah, this is an extraordinary story. It's based on what happened in France during the Franco-Prussian War, where 1870, 1871, the Prussian army invaded France and surrounded the capital, Paris, with 2.5 million people inside it. And they completely cut it off. They sealed it off, so there was no way of getting out. No communications by river, by telegraph, in any way. And the only way they discovered they could send messages out was, of course, by balloon. Mm. And the extraordinary thing is in 4.5 months, they sent out 67 balloons, all right? All hydrogen balloons, all carrying airmail, private letters. They got out over 2 million letters so people could write outside to their families. They got out some of the political leaders. The first balloon carried a letter to the London Times. Can you imagine this? Saying, listen, what's going on here in Paris? You need to understand what. So, and those balloons went all over. One of them, you imagine a map. They go in all different directions. All they've got to do is fly over the Prussian troops. Once they do that, they're safe. But where are they going to come down? One of them flew for 15 hours from Paris. And when it came down, it was on a snow-covered mountainside in Norway.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, God. And they had 3 airmail bags, and amazingly, they managed to deliver it. They brought it back to the capital of Kristiansand and so on. And I've seen some of those letters, some of which, incidentally, I've seen one which is addressed to San Francisco, which apparently was delivered. Now, where Victor Hugo fits in is that the man running these balloons, they're entirely amateurs, was a remarkable man called Felix Nadar, who was a photographer and took the first aerial photographs from a balloon above Paris. And he wrote to Victor Hugo, the poet and novelist, saying, will you write us a pamphlet saying that we have the right to fly, le droit au vol, the right to fly? And Hugo wrote this extraordinary pamphlet about what he called breaking the ancient tyranny of gravity. Amazing pamphlet, and how we were built to fly, and how this would change. This would somehow bring, he thought, universal peace, because there'd be no more political borders. Mankind would speak to mankind. Transportation would be transformed. It's an extraordinary pamphlet he wrote. And in that time, you know, they did hope. They had passionate hope that the freedom of the skies would lead to general freedom, political freedom, and so on, and the geography and the exploration would open up parts of the world. As we know, it's turned out slightly differently, but it's very moving to read these accounts. And Hugo, he would have made a great advertising man. He was very good with the punchlines, right?
Richard, how did people get mail back into Paris during the Prussian siege?
Very good. This is Nadar as well. What they did was they took with the balloons baskets of homing pigeons, okay? When the letters were read and the replies came, they pinned up the replies on a board, they photographed them, they reduced the photographs to tiny, what we'd call microfilms, that they could roll up and put in tiny tubes which were fitted to the legs of the homing pigeons, who then flew back into Paris. And of course, the Prussian troops couldn't shoot down the pigeons. So they had this amazing exchange. And again, Nadar, the photographic genius, helped to invent this idea of what we now call microfilm. So it's very moving, because the private citizens, it was terrible. They were starving, and there wasn't a horse alive in Paris. They'd all been shot to eat. They'd cut down all the trees in the Bois de Boulogne. It was winter. So to be able to have an exchange of letters with people in your family outside in France was very, very important for morale. And the story of the way they gradually invented this, they even had the first airmail newspaper, which was printed by the modern paper Le Figaro, which had just been founded then, and it was called La Poste Aérienne. And every week they sent out this newspaper by balloon, so throughout the country in France, people could find out what was happening to their friends and their family in Paris. It's an amazing story, and the pilots, often untrained, often their first flights, were extraordinary people, extraordinary. And as I say, somehow they got 67 of these balloons out. So it's a marvelous use of ballooning. Balloons never go from A to B. They go from A to somewhere else. But in this occasion, it didn't matter. As long as they didn't land in the Prussian armed lines, as long as they flew over that, they could go in any direction, and it worked. So it's a fabulous story. And it might be worth mentioning that in the book, because it's a history book, I was able to research also the pictures of this. So I've got, I think it's something like 140 pictures in the book. And there's some of the Paris ones, propaganda pictures showing the balloons and so on, are very moving, I think. Mm. And they go right back to the earliest 1780 posters and so on. So they're all in there.
You know, a picture that I found very poignant was of the ballooning priest.
Oh, yes. The balloon priest. I mean, that's an extraordinary. There's a long history of balloons going up for charity, for raising charity. And this particular story was a chap in South America in 2008 who wanted to raise money for a truck stop, trucker stop. He wanted to build this as a kind of rest place and also a kind of meditative center and raise money for it on one of the big highways. And he decided he'd go up in a cluster with a cluster of like party balloons, but 1,000 of them, and raise money that way. And he did it once in spring 2008, and it worked. And the second time he did it, he was sitting simply in a chair with a GPS, you know, sat-nav and a cell phone. And he went up, and the balloon went much higher than he expected, this group of balloons. It went, he phoned the Coast Guards when he was at 19,000 feet, which is, Everest is 29, so he was going high.
Yeah.
But the balloon was swept out to sea, and he was lost, and his body was found 2 months later, what was left of it, in the sea. But it was a very heroic thing to do, and to risk his life, and he did successfully raise money for this trucker station. And there are many stories like that in the book, people who are motivated by very philanthropic reasons. One of the stories is near me, the hospital near me in Norwich, 200 years ago, just been founded. And a man called Major Money made a very similar a charity flight. He couldn't control his balloon either, and he was swept out to sea. This is in 1785. And the story, he remained floating in the sea for 5 hours, and he just kept enough gas in the balloon to act as a kind of buoyancy aid. And in the end, he was picked up by a fishing trawler and brought back. And, of course, he raised more money than anybody else for that hospital and founded it. So that's one of the elements of the stories of ballooning. It's not purely showmanship.
No, and there's also... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and or purely science, but we might talk about the science as well. We haven't mentioned that.
Really. Yes, James Glaisher and Henry Coxwell, what pair. And I just can't believe they kept going up. Tell us a little bit about what they were trying to achieve and the results they had.
And this is also, the balloon is a piece of scientific equipment. And although it doesn't go very well to A to B, it goes up very well. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the 1860s. And no one knew, and this is what I tried to get across the reader in the book, no one knew what it was like to go high. No one knew if you flew up in a cloud, would you be electrocuted? No one knew how hot it might be or how cold. No one knew where you stopped breathing. So James Glaisher was the president of the British Meteorological Society, and the British Association for the Advancement of Science, the same as the one, the American Association, but this is the British one, commissioned him to have a balloon built, high-altitude balloon, go up as high as you can, find out what there is up there. And he and his pilot, Henry Coxwell, went up one morning in 1862, the two of them. He took an entire sort of Victorian laboratory equipment, wonderful pictures I've got of this, with barometers, chronometers, compasses. It's like a mini laboratory. And he sat there calmly taking measurements as the balloon went up. How hot is the air? How is the air pressure changing, which is a form of altimeter? Extraordinary man. He just kept making the notes. I worked out he made 12 readings every minute. They went up for an hour and a half, at which point they were approaching 29,000 feet, which is the height of Everest. And they were rising at 1,000 feet a minute. And suddenly they began to feel, first thing is, Glacier said, he realized he couldn't read the instruments because his sight was going. And, of course, what was happening, they were asphyxiating. Mm-hmm. They were going into an area where there was no oxygen. Nobody knew where this was or how it would work. And he, Glacier, lost consciousness. He slumped back in the basket. And his pilot, Henry Coxwell, was trying to pull the release valve to bring the balloon down, still going up, so 30,000 feet, 31,000 feet. And the line got caught in the hoop. The balloons have a hoop above the basket. Mm-hmm. And can you believe this? He had to climb up into the hoop while his own sight was going. And the other effect of no oxygen is you lose muscular strength. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't grip properly. He got up into the hoop, and he couldn't pull the line. His hand wouldn't close on it. It was going black from cold. So he hooked it into his arm, dropped back into the balloon basket. Again, we're now probably 32,000 feet. And the one way he found of pulling it is he put it in his between his teeth, and he pulled the release line that way. And then he went to his friend Glacier and woke, brought him round. He hadn't died, but he'd passed out. And there's a wonderful Victorian exchange. This is, you know, what now we call the right stuff. Do you have the right stuff?
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
And the Victorian version of this was Mr. Coxwell shook the great meteorologist scientist, Mr. Glacier, by the shoulder to bring him round. And what he said was, Mr. Glacier, do try and take some more readings from your instrument. Do try. And he did. And I've seen the thing. It begins approximately 13 minutes later. The measurements start again, and they came down safely. They'd gone probably 7 miles high, and they established by this very important thing, the beginnings of a real science of meteorology. What they established was the biosphere, in which we, all animals, us, can breathe, is only 7 miles thick. You imagine that in walking terms. Walk 7 miles, thing you can do pretty easily in under 2 hours. That's the thickness of the skin upwards. And beyond that is a stratosphere where living things cannot exist. And so they established for the first time that we live in this very beautiful but fragile planet. And they begin to write about the Earth in this way. And he publishes his papers. And then they go on to work on barometer pressures and the notion of the stratosphere. They establish that there's this new stratosphere where the temperature remains steady. So you begin to get a science of the upper air. But the thing that also fascinated me, just tiny detail, when they came down, this is what Victorian scientists like. Imagine they'd been up there. They'd both nearly died. They'd had this terrifying experience. They came down. They landed the balloon in the countryside near Ludlow. Nothing near, just in the middle of the countryside. They packed up the balloon. They left it, and the two of them, arm in arm, walked 7 miles, exactly the distance they climbed, to the nearest building, which was a pub, a tavern, where they both had a pint of beer.
Or maybe more than one after
well,
that
maybe
experience.
More than one, but that's what they admitted to. So that kind of approach to Victorian science is a thing also I write about, and also the beginnings of meteorology. So again, balloons take you in very interesting and unexpected directions, I think.
My guest is British Academy Fellow Richard Holmes. He's the author of the new book, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. If you would like to read a copy of this truly fascinating, really engaging book, you can call in now and receive it as a thank you gift with a contribution to KERA at or above the level of $10 a month. Do this at 888-694-6931 or KERA.org online. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. What a great conversation. I mean, I'm just, no pun intended, but kind of carried away by
he's riveting.
Just want to update everybody. When you make your call to 888-694-6931 or contribute at KERA.org, you're helping us meet a $35,000 challenge today. That's right. We've heard from Ann McGee Cooper and Associates, as well as two generous supporters and listeners of the station. And they've all said, hey, if the station can raise $35,000, we'll kick in an additional $3,500. And Chris, we've got $5,731 left to go. That's a pretty doable number. Actually, we could probably even get there by the end of the hour this hour and not even have to wait till 7 o'clock to make this challenge if you would be the next one to make your contribution.
888-694-6931 or kera.org. Again, we have copies of Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air by Richard Holmes as thank you gifts today at the level of $120 or more. This is the perfect gift, I mean, obviously to yourself, but there's always that person in your life who is curious about everything. And the spirit of this book is curious and, you know, very interesting. The science is good. The sort of ideas expressed within it are fascinating. And it's just written in such a lovely lyrical style that it's very hard to put it down.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and I read and put down a lot of books, and this one was kept my attention.
Well, and we, when you make your contribution to get a copy of Richard Holmes' book, Falling Upwards, we'll also automatically enter you into a drawing for passes to the Lone Star Film Festival, which runs from November 7th through the 10th in Fort Worth. You can check out the complete listing of films and locations at LoneStarFilmSociety.com. But on November 8th, the winner of this drawing will also be invited to the Lone Star Festival Ball, Chris. Mm. And Chris, you're not eligible.
Because I work here.
Where Lyle Lovett will receive the Stephen Bruton Award. So don't forget, you're automatically entered when you make your contribution today in any amount at KERA.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931. I'm a Lyle Lovett fan. So
yeah, he's fantastic. So we know that you listen to the show on a regular basis. You listen to the station certainly on a regular basis. Now is the perfect time for you to make your gift of support at KERA.org or 888-694-6931. This is the not-for-profit organization in North Texas that serves you every single day. It also serves the broader community, but your contribution both acknowledges the value you receive from KERA and allows us to continue providing this kind of content for everybody else as well. 888-694-6931 is our number. You can also go online to kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Richard Holmes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Richard Holmes. He's a fellow of the British Academy, and he has a new book out called Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Richard, I have to confess, I could not get enough of the story of Sophie Blanchard. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah. People often ask, was this only a boys-only stuff? Hmm. Not at all. There were some very, very brave and brilliant women balloonists. Sophie Blanchard was one of them, a young French woman born in La Rochelle, and we're talking around the 1790s, the 1800s here. And she married another French balloonist called Jean-Pierre Blanchard, who incidentally was the first man to fly a balloon here in America. From Philadelphia, he brought his balloon over and flew out of the city across the river. But he was getting old and ancient. Sophie was his second wife, and she was much younger. And when he died, she, at the age in her early 20s, took over the ballooning, and she reinvented ballooning. She used to wear these wonderful outfits, these white silky dresses with huge feathers hats on the top, so she could be seen. She redesigned her balloon with a tiny basket. We've got pictures of it. I describe it as not much bigger than a champagne bucket.
Yeah.
It was unbelievably small. And she was very, very skillful. She spent whole nights up in the air and came down in the morning. She got such a reputation for this flying that Napoleon, when he became emperor, he appointed her, not a bloke, but her, Sophie Blanchard, as the official balloonist of the French Empire at that point, okay? And she did a lot of celebrations for him. And what she invented, crazy when you think about it, hydrogen balloon, we all know how inflammable hydrogen is. She invented a fireworks show from her balloon, which got more and more complicated with great booms, with Roman candles and lights burning off. And she would, at any great celebration, she would appear and she would fly over the crowd, particularly over some of the big gardens in Paris, and let off these fireworks. When Napoleon, you know, lost at Waterloo and was exiled, and the king, the Bourbon kings came back, no problem. Sophie became the official balloonist for the king, for the monarchy. And she gave these displays, which were known. People came over, the British particularly came over to see this. She used to fly over the Luxembourg Gardens and the Tivoli Gardens. And she, there are wonderful pictures of her, as I say, with this tremendous outfit, with this wonderful feathered hat and so on. And she became a heroine. I've discovered that she also flew down in Italy. And once she landed a little tiny village in the Italian Alps. And to this day, this village has a Sophie Blanchard Festival Day.
Hmm.
They celebrate her. The only thing about this story is it ends in tragedy because in 1819, when she was still in her late 30s, she was doing a very complicated display above the Tivoli Gardens in Paris, and the balloon caught fire because of the fireworks. And she managed to somehow bring the balloon down while it was on fire, but it landed on a rooftop in Paris, and she slid down and fell off the roof and killed herself. There is a very moving monument to her. If anybody's in Paris, in Père Lachaise, most people wouldn't ask for this, ask for the monument of Sophie Blanchard, the balloonist. And there it is, the balloon. It's a rather a noble thing. She was a wonderful example of the kind of courage that interests me. And, of course, she was a heroine, particularly to young women, you know, who suddenly this is what could be done. And at the other end of the book, in 1908, we'd be jumping a whole century, I tell the story, do you remember, of Dolly Shepherd?
Yeah.
The young parachute woman who used to go up, again, can you believe the courage of this, on a gas balloon, no basket at all, simply holding onto a trapeze bar, all right? And she had a parachute attached to the bottom of the balloon, and at around 10,000 feet, she would pull a release and would parachute down to Earth. And she, again, became an extraordinary figure and had a great following. And again, she was a heroine for young women. You know, this is entirely new, what could be done, and this courage. And the story I tell is one occasion, this is in 1904, I think, she is asked to go up with another young woman, a great friend of hers called Louise May, on another trapeze. So the two of them go up in the same balloon with hanging on to these two trapeze bars side by side. They get up to 10 to 12,000 feet. She's got a tiny little altimeter. There's a photograph of her around her wrist, like a wristband, and that's the only bit of equipment she got that tells her how high she is. When she's ready to release, she says to her friend Louis, all right, pull the release, and we'll go down. And Louis pulls the release, and her parachute won't open. It's jammed. She's still hanging beneath the balloon. There's no way of getting herself free. And so Dolly Shepherd, her friend, is presented with this problem. The balloon is going up. If she pulls her own parachute, she will be safe. She will be released and will float back to Earth. But her own friend, Louis, would just go on up and up in this a case of falling upwards and would almost certainly be killed. So what does Dolly do? And this is, it's such an amazing story. She gets Louis, who is so frightened she can hardly move. She says, Louis, I'm going to swing to you. And when I swing over to you, I want you to take one hand off the trapeze bar, put it round my neck, and then the other arm round my neck so you're holding on to me, and I will take you down on my parachute. And she manages to talk. Imagine this, 12,000 feet, 13,000 feet. She talks Louis, keeps her calm, so she makes this transfer. So she's simply hanging on with her arms around Dolly's neck, and Dolly says, okay, I'm going to pull the release, and this parachute works. and she brings her down safely from 12,000 feet. Amazing piece of courage. Mavis poster they made, she became a sort of local heroine. And again, it interested me in what is the kind of person who would do that. Very interesting. She went. Dolly lived into her 90s. She had a family, and towards the end of her life, she wrote a very interesting book about this. And so this is another element. It interests me both in her, for her personality, what she actually did technically, but also how important she had this big following among the young women of the day. This is before the First World War. She was doing something. She was doing something amazingly courageous that inspired people. So that's a kind of another element to the book.
Well, when you say, Richard, that you wanted to know what kind of person would do this, did you conclude like 90% courageous and amazing and 10% absolutely crazy?
That's very, remember, my real training is a biographer. So I'm really interested in lives. And yes, it's an incredible cross-section of people you get. Some of them, like Glaisher, are these pure, cool scientists who are doing for science, and that's very impressive. Some of them are slightly showmen, like we talked about Charles Green, you know, who ballooned through the night. He's a sort of showman, but he's a very good balloonist. And some of them are just crazy exhibitionists. And some of them, we haven't even talked about the American balloonist, the great John Wise, who flew halfway across America. He, one of his early flights, he flew from Cincinnati almost to the Canadian border, over 800 miles. That's an amazing story. And what he was trying to do was to pioneer the first airmail, the idea you could lift letters from, as it were, the Western Front and bring them back to the Eastern Seaboard. It didn't quite work out that way because the railroad arrived and was more efficient. But that's very interesting. And an entrepreneur who sees if you apply science and engineering, you can do something with it. You can turn it into a really useful business. I'm very interested in that. So it's a complete cross-section of people. And, of course, all the time, the writers who write about it, H.G. Wells is another very, very interesting thing. And even a modern author that some of our listeners may have read called Ian McEwan, modern British author, wonderful book called Enduring Love, which opens with a wonderful balloon sequence in the first two chapters, which is also included in my book, and again, pictures from the film and so on. So for a biographer, it is absolutely fascinating to study this, and I hope for the reader. Well, it's full of stories, isn't it, Chris?
It is.
Full of stories.
And we haven't even touched on, half the amazing things in the book. Richard Holmes, I am so thankful to you for making time for us today. Thank you so much.
That's a pleasure. And can I say very quickly that I am a great supporter of National Public Radio. I do a lot of work for BBC World Service. I think National Public Radio, and you haven't asked me to say this, but I believe it's one of the glories of American communication, and long may it thrive. So I'm with you on the pledge, all right?
Thank you so much. Really appreciate that.
Okay. It's what I believe.
Richard Holmes is a fellow of the British Academy and author of the new book, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. We have thank you copies of the book available at 888-694-6931 or kera.org. You can also find out about the history of balloons. Jeff, you may not know about this. During the U.S. Civil War, really interesting. I won't give everything away, but the Union Army had a fleet of like 8 balloons. The Confederacy had one balloon made of recycled dress silks from women in the South when the Confederate Army decided it needed a hot air balloon. And the way they were used is detailed in Falling Upwards, the new book by Richard Holmes, which we would love to send you as a gift when you make a contribution at or above the level of $10 a month.
888-694-6931. You never know what you're going to learn on Think. And we went from vampires and werewolves and books about fictional Jesus to, in the first hour today with Anne Rice, to it's a very thoughtful history, as Richard Holmes, the work that he produces is always very thoughtful, of travel in the air, the early, early days of travel in the air, and some great stories.
It's always wonderful to us to be able to bring you people who are so enthusiastic about their subjects. You know, listening to Richard Holmes talk, his writing is every bit as sort of enthusiastic and delightful to consume as listening to him on the air. It's our pleasure, Jeff and Stephen Becker, who now produces Think, sort of day to day, work really hard to find people that will be interesting to you. We know the kinds of things that will catch your attention. We know that sometimes you turn on the radio and don't think that you're interested in the subject at all, and sometimes you end up sticking with us for the whole hour. That's one of the delights of having an hour and being able to go really unexpected places with a particular interview, and that's possible because of your contributions to the station at 888-694-6931.
Or online at kera.org. Don't forget, we have copies of Richard Holmes' book, Falling Upwards, at the $120 membership level. Everyone who contributes today is also automatically entered into a drawing for passes to the Lone Star Film Festival, which isn't this weekend, but it's next weekend, including tickets to the Lone Star Festival Ball, where Lyle Lovett will be presented with the Stephen Bruton Award on the 8th of November. So somebody's going to win that, and it might be you if you make your contribution at kera.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931. And don't forget, Chris, we're working on that goal of $35,000, the challenge, by 7 p.m. this evening.
We have $5,483 left to go. We can easily get well below that amount. I think we can easily get below $4,000 in the next few minutes here if you will be the next person to call. You only really, your job is done once you have made your contribution. 888-694-6931. Or if you're interested in a thank you gift, a copy of Richard Holmes' book, a copy of Anne Rice's book from the last hour, or virtually any of the things that we have talked about throughout the fundraising campaign, most except for maybe some tickets, are still available. We would love to hook you up if you've been waiting for us to mention something again. By all means, please go online or ask about it on the phone, and chances are we can still make that happen for you.
888-694-6931 on the web at kera.org. You know, you might be busy this afternoon. You may not be listening. You may not have, you certainly won't have Chris or me or Chris and me to encourage you to make your contribution. You won't have us to remind you of how much you love KERA, how important it is to you, what a huge part of your day-to-day life this radio station is. And, you know, when you make your contribution, the membership campaign ends for you right then. So do it right now, because you might not be listening later, and you certainly won't have us later today to remind you of how important it is that you do your part this afternoon.
KERA and public radio in general really are here for people who are interested in learning about all kinds of things, want to understand the world better, want to explore ideas. That's not necessarily something that is top priority in other media organizations. And it's not to say that many of them don't do excellent work, but you know the approach is different with public radio. You know the way we look at stories, the way we sort of take things apart and look at multiple angles. That's something unique to public radio. And the formula for keeping public radio strong is unique as well. Rather than using commercial advertising, we support the station by going directly to you. Many of you are incredibly generous. But even if you can just do a few dollars a month or a one-time gift of whatever amount, your contribution does work for you and for the entire community. And anytime you want to check in on how we're doing with that money, flip on the radio to 90.1 and you find out right then.
And we know you've been listening for a while. I mean, maybe the first time you heard a membership campaign, you're like, huh? Back to the modern rock station. You know, and then the next time you heard a membership campaign, you thought, oh, this is why there's no commercials, you know, when I'm listening to the station. And then maybe it took a little longer to go back to the hard rock or the progressive rock station or the classical station or wherever else you go when you don't want to listen to the greatness that is KERA. But now you're listening to the membership campaign breaks.
To the bitter end.
You're listening to it because you're like, well, there's going to be something good in a minute. And there is. There's going to be NPR News headlines. And then you're going to hear The World. And then you're going to hear Fresh Air. And then you're going to hear All Things Considered. And then you're going to hear Marketplace. And you know the schedule now. And it's part of your day. And you think, oh, I'm hearing PBS NewsHour on the radio. It must be 7 o'clock.
I hope dinner's ready.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, you're totally, you've integrated this service into your life. You use it. You depend on it. You would miss it if it was gone. And this is the one time a year, maybe, that you can make your contribution to KERA. And your membership's good for the whole year. So we'll bug you again a little bit in January. But right now, this is a great time to join.
888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. Check out thank you gifts. Many of you don't take a thank you gift, and that's fine, too. Then we just put all of your contribution to work for the station. But listen, if there's something that we mentioned that you'd like to have, let us know about it. We want to make you happy. We try very hard to serve you all year with great programming, and we know that you're listening because we see the numbers. Please support the station that means so much to your life. Make sure that it's here not only for you in the future, but for the rest of the North Texas community.